Hello everyone, I'm Claire Wright.
And I'm Eve Rees.
And we are historians. And if this introduction sounds to you like a confession or an act of sharing our addictions, well, you're right. We are here to tell you about our addiction to the archives.
So welcome to Season 7 of our podcast, Archive Fever, where each episode will be conducting intimate conversations with writers, artists, curators, fellow historians and other victims of the research bug.
We'll talk to these archive addicts about what kind of archives they use, how often they use them, when they got their first hit and what is their funniest, saddest, most frustrating and most illuminating experience in the archives.
And as always, we'll be asking the question, what madness is this?
Today on our Pick Nerd podcast, we're coming to you from Gadigal Land in Sydney, where we are thrilled to welcome a legend into the circle of Archives Anonymous. Our guest is one of Australia's most celebrated contemporary photographers. In words and images, she has spent 50 years documenting the changing social landscape of Australia, and in particular, the lives, the joys and the struggles of Aboriginal Australians. Juno Jeames is a Hungarian-born Australian photographer who has also worked as a performer, theatre director, writer and publisher. Juno was born into a Jewish family in war-torn Hungary in 1944, and with her parents she came to Australia in 1949. She studied at the University of Sydney and the National Institute of Dramatic Arts, otherwise known as NIDA, graduating in 1964. In 1968, Juno directed The Human Body, Australia's first experimental theatre group. She worked in theatre and film and worked in London sporadically in the late 1960s and 70s, where she wrote for the London-based underground newspapers. While in Bohemian London, Juno performed in some of Yoko Ono's work, including the avant-garde film Bottoms and a performance piece The Scream at the Perfume Garden. Though talented in many art forms, it was photography that became Juno's medium of choice for both expressing and documenting her kaleidoscopic world. She held her first solo exhibition, We Wait No More, in 1982, and the same year she exhibited photographs in the group shows After the Tent Embassy and APMIRA, Artists for Aboriginal Land Rights. To list just a few of her many honours and accomplishments, Juno was commissioned by Parks Australia to celebrate the 25th anniversary of the historic handback of Uluru in 1985. In 2003, the National Portrait Gallery exhibited her portraits of Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander reconciliation activists and personalities in an exhibition Proof, Portraits from the Movement, many of which were acquired. She was one of 10 photographers invited to document the National Apology in Canberra in 2008 and was photographer in residence to the 2009 Sydney Writers' Festival. Juno was a committee member of the Ballarat International Photo Biennale, and she's had exhibitions at countless regional, commercial and university galleries, many of whom have acquired her work. From 1986 to 2010, Juno ran Paperbark Press, the acclaimed poet Robert Adamson, which published many of Australia's leading poets. Together they lived and worked on the Hawkesbury River. Robert sadly passed in 2022. And that's where Juno still has her photography studio and the most extraordinary photographic archive of 5 decades worth of social, political and cultural memory. Juno's recently published book, Until Justice Comes, is a carefully curated and annotated survey of 50 years of her photographs of the movement, as it's often called in the book, for Aboriginal civil and land rights in Australia. This is what David Maloof had to say about Juno and her book. In a country so poor at keeping in touch with its social history, Juno Jeames is a national treasure. Here she brings her close connection to Indigenous life and consciousness and the keen eye of a master photographer to 5 decades of Indigenous activity of politics, the arts and the intimacies of daily being, an indispensable record. Juno Jeames, welcome to Archive Fever.
Thank you so much. I'm thrilled to be here with you both.
Juno, you're 81 now, and I must say I'm feeling a bit like when we had another legendary octogenarian mischief maker in our studio, Joan Nessel, a couple of seasons ago. Do you know Joan?
No.
I'm a bit daunted with such a rich and full life's work to look back upon, but also not quite sure what might happen next with you. So we'll get to Until Justice Comes later, but let's start with little Juno, who came to Australia as a five-year-old. Tell us about your early years with your parents, sort of the prehistory of the woman who would go on to amass this remarkable archival legacy.
Thanks so much, Claire. That's such an important question because it has so much to do with how I see. Because I was always aware that I'm not an Australian-born person. Therefore, it gave me a freedom that I discovered to question what actually does it mean to be Australian. And in a way, I was a kind of like an archaeologist from Venus, you know, always questioning, saying, oh, how to put this puzzle together of what makes this Australian people, what makes this definition of what it is to be Australian, and forming my relationship with country as I went along.
Do you think that's a survival skill for a small person to have to excavate in that way?
I thought it was fascinating. I thought it was quite a gift in a way. My family were very questioning people, and so I took nothing for granted about anything. And much later in life, it's really interesting to note that it gave me a freedom in relation to exploring Aboriginal people and culture who were invisible at that time. And Martin Sharp, for example, my dear friend, said to me towards the end of his life, you were so fortunate that you weren't carrying this baggage of Australian history. And I envied you that freedom. And I think that's a fairly reflection that I maybe didn't know it at the time as a five-year-old because it was all such a puzzle to unravel and find my place in. But gradually, particularly in my later years and as a photographer and a thinker, it was a tremendous asset to me, I think.
Tell us about the war-torn Europe that your parents migrated out of and the post-war Australia that they migrated to. Tell us something about that journey.
Well, look, I mean, I really know these stories from my mother, but her aunt, my great-aunt, was the head of the National Theatre of Hungary, and she was a formidable woman, gay and out, since the 1930s. And she's why I'm sitting here, shielded my mother and I. And I spent the first 5 years of my life in her beautiful apartment on the banks of the Danube. So my parents came from this very rich intellectual circle. And even though the stories are mixed with, oh, we had to all, you know, go down to the cellar and aunt or uncle would arrange for a carpet and a candlestick to be brought down. And my girlfriend was this dancer who was having an affair with Nijinsky. I mean, these are the stories I grew up with. So, you know, I feel very fortunate in coming from a very leftist intellectual cultural powerhouse that was surviving the war.
And then what was the culture that your parents migrated into, sort of out of this bohemian intellectual left-wing Budapest family and then arriving in 1950s Sydney? What was the landscape like?
They seemed to form a circle of fellow Hungarian immigré who were, you know, my extended family. And they were all getting used to this Australian cultural life and making their way in it together. So it was quite a fascinating thing. And when I asked my mother, did you know these people before? And she said, some of them yes, some of them no. But they formed this circle. And within 10 years, we were living in the eastern suburbs and I was doing drawing classes with Judy Kassab. And they had a very rich cultural life, for which I'm very grateful.
Juno, I believe your first encounter with photography came in 1964 with Nothing Personal by James Baldwin and Richard Avedon. So Nothing Personal comprises a long essay written by Baldwin at the height of the civil rights movement in America that's been called both a eulogy and a declaration of will, both a call to action and an appeal to love and to life. And it's complemented by photographs by Baldwin's high school mate, as it happened, yep. Richard Avedon, who's now best known for his celebrity portraits. But in Nothing Personal, he probes the complexities and the contradictions kind of at the heart of the American condition. And the book deploys both image and text to examine the formation of identity and the bonds that really underlie the human connection. Why did this book become integral to your own work? And can you tell us a little bit about what drew you to photography as an art form above, say, print journalism, the tools of Avedon, not Baldwin?
That's a great question. My mother bought back that book from the Museum of Modern Art in 1964 when it was published by Penguin, and I could not put it down. And it showed me the power of photography, because what these two ex-high school mates, both geniuses, I think, did together was an analysis of American society. And really, James Baldwin's question all his life was, what do you do about the disease of racism? How do you unpick it? And the way they were looking to unpick it, because I've analysed this book for years, right, was by showing all these magnificent portraits of Fabian, the daughters of the American Revolution, Allen Ginsberg naked, the Nazi Party, and so it goes on. Andy Warhol and the gang, you know, everybody. Dissecting this whole visual history of this culture put together with the sublime text, why is it, it begins, why is it, I always tear up at this, a black man can't walk down the street at 3 a.m. without being arrested. Tell me why that. So this book has been seminal to me, and I looked at it and I could see what photography could be. Photography with intention. So to the second part of the question, in 1970, I came back from London and I was invited to be part of the Yellow House. And they thought I'd go on doing this, you know, theatre thing that I was doing. And I said to Martin Shop, I'm not doing that. I'm called to the Central Desert. And so was my friend and ex-partner, Michael Glasheen, a genius filmmaker that nobody's heard of. And he had the brilliant idea to make this film of the stories embedded in Uluru with single framing devices. He was a Buckminster Fuller guy. He was an architect before he was a filmmaker and then ended up as an artist. And so we decided to make this film together. And as we were reading Strelow, Stanner, Mountford, all the texts, I suddenly thought, hang on, we don't know who the holders of these stories are, if they want this film, if they want it to be made. So I just said, I am going up to find them.
So timestamp this for us. What date is it?
1970. So I set up from the Yellow House to find the traditional elders of those stories. And within 3 days, I was camped at Ebenezer Downs on the way to Uluru. And when the Aboriginal family who was working on Ebenezer Downs, and I'd hitchhiked out there with a little box of food.
I was going to ask, because it's like 1970s, it's not like there's roads and caravan parks. And
exactly. But there was this wonderful frontier stuff. You could hitchhike. I hitchhiked on trucks, on planes, little private planes, all kinds of stuff, right? But to get out, so I hitchhiked out to Ebenezer Downs, and I could see the campsite sort of shimmering just 400 metres away, something like that. And then I got out of the truck and I thought, God, how am I going to explain what I'm doing, you know? Will they understand this? Will this make any sense to anybody? And also I was overcome by the land itself, you know, the red earth, the light, everything. And I just sat down there for about an hour. And no sooner had I got up than the kids from the camp came running down and they picked up my swag and my box. 5 minutes later, I'm sitting there with a mug of tea in my hand around the fire, and Mary, the elder, sort of knocks me on the shoulder and she said, you arrived in Alice Springs 3 days ago. We know who you're looking for. He'll be here by and by. Sure enough, the next day, up he comes out of the desert, out of the red dust, with a little sugar bag in his hand, as I'd actually dreamt him in Avesbury a year before. He appeared to me in a dream, and he patted the ground 3 times. And I woke up and thought, what is that? And I went running around my writer friends saying, what does that mean? They said, we don't know. You have to go and find out. But I found out it's a call. And he was the elder I was looking for. His name was Captain Number One. He was a major Anangu lawman.
God, Juno, my mind is just bouncing with questions about all of this. So, Juno, how did your urban, intellectual, European parents feel about their 25-year-old daughter hitchhiking off to the centre of Australia?
This is the extraordinary thing about my parents. They never questioned me. They just said, oh, that's what she's doing now. We don't understand it. We'll just stand by her and see what comes of it.
Did you have a camera with you? Had you trained to take photographs by this stage?
Well, you see, the end of that story, of the Ebenezer Down story, is that I ended up camped with Captain and his family. We moved back to Alice Springs and were in a fringe camp there. And eventually I said to him, why are we here? Why are we not on Armitage or, you know, one of the reserves? He said, we are. We got nothing. He said, we're not allowed to speak our culture. We're not allowed to speak our language. We're not allowed to practice our culture. And somehow that enraged me. That was like a political awakening to me. And I thought, a film, I was a filmmaker at that point. And I thought, a film, what if people don't see it? And I actually, going back to Nothing Personal, I started to see in still images. And I thought, still images are portable. You can have them in magazines, in books, in newspapers, on the wall. They're infinite. And not only that, they're personal. Because your relationship with an image that you're looking at is personal to you. And I understood we had to change the consciousness of a nation. So photography seemed to be the way.
So you chose photography very much because it was the most effective medium.
Absolutely.
To convey you wanted to convey.
Exactly, yeah. Right, Ives. That's when I picked up a camera.
Yeah, and were you formally trained in photography?
I became formally trained. I picked up my training as I could along the way. First of all, I just picked the brains of every photographer I knew, Johnny Lewis, Greg Waite, friends that I had. But eventually I ended up getting a scholarship to the Oxford Photographic Workshop in 76, and there meeting a guy who was the editor of Creative Camera, the best photography magazine in the UK at that time, who said, oh, I've seen your photographs. You really need to go and work with Lisette Medel. I'm going to ring her up. She has a class in Venice at the Biennale. I'm going to get you into it. So things like that happened, you know, in the great gifts of my friends. So I picked up some pretty top-notch advice and teaching from some of the master photographers, and that's the way I did it. Just along the way, when I'd hear of someone giving a workshop, I would be there.
And at that time, were you thinking of yourself foremost as an artist or as an activist, or are those two identities kind of inseparable for you?
In this body of work, inseparable, yeah. I had intention, you know. And intention's what people very rarely look at when they look at photography, and it's actually key to what that work is about.
Intention and composition. So that takes me back to your original point that you made about your background. You said where you came from helps you see everything and helps you see the way that you have perceived your life, your journey as a migrant to this country. So tell us something about how you compose your images. What goes in them and what do you leave out of them?
Okay, that's a great question. Now, for example, I worked for 3 years with Woomera, Mornington Island dancers. I had my small son with me, 1.5, and they were touring. They were one of the first mobs to have that genius idea that you take the culture into schools and present it to school children and teach them about the culture, the dances, the stories, to educate another generation to open their eyes to what Aboriginal culture was about, because it was so unknown at that time, really. And so when I was doing that work, I was looking after the women and the children, but I was also their photographer. So what I would do is I'd go around every campfire and I'd sit down with people and I'd say, what should we show? What do you want the world to know about your community and your life? And the elders came back to me with this answer: you show them that our culture is still strong, my girl. Because that was being questioned. And then I had to think about that and say, well, how can I show that? And then I realized that everything is actually part of the culture. So the images on the cover of the book that is from a camp on the leeward side of the island waiting for these fish to come in. They do it every year and they just watch the surface and it's so calm and we camped out there for a week. It was just beautiful. You'd know this kind of experience very well. And then eventually there was some fish movement in the distance and the guys would run in with these prepared nets and pull in this great cascade of these fish, the Duna and the Wanna, and share them out among everybody. So that became my practice. I'd discuss it with people. And sometimes I'd be given a clear instruction, sometimes not. But that was my way of working. That was the kind of collaboration I sought.
It strikes me that that is quite an early adoption of the methodology of collaboration and nothing about us without us.
Yes.
And so do you feel like that was something that was just very instinctual to you? Was it something about your own family's experience of dispossession and dispersal, that you had a particular form of identification? How did you come to know that what you had to do was not be an outsider looking in, but be an insider asking the right questions?
I felt it. It was a purely emotional connectedness and respect. It was the respectful thing to do. In every community, I'm the student. I'm learning. I'm learning all the time. In every community, things are different. So I am this sort of walking library of all that I've learned, you know, in all these different settings. And that's the process I feel comfortable with.
Juno, I'm thinking about another famous photographer, Diane Arbus, and something that she said once. She said, "What I'm trying to describe is that it's impossible to get out of your skin into somebody else's, that somebody else's tragedy is not the same as your own." I'm wondering how much harder you think it is to inhabit somebody else's skin when they don't share the same skin colour. Does it make any difference, or where's the line between identification and objectification?
Well, Mum Shirl used to say to me, "I don't care if you're black, white or brindle, you haven't got a racist bone in your body." And so that was just, as I say, a natural view to me, and I did identify. If anybody in the community reminded me that I was a white girl, I was terribly offended. You know, like, how could you say that to me? I'm one of the gang, you know. But of course, I have to live with that as being true. So that's the ambiguity I learned to live with.
And was that an uncomfortable feeling?
Sometimes.
Are you constantly negotiating that line? Do you feel that the camera puts up a screen between you and the world that you're capturing?
No, I think it's the opposite. I understood the power of the camera to reinforce identity, and in my case, in a very positive way. So here was a people who had been neglected, who had been denied, and I could bring up a camera and remind them how powerful they were, how beautiful they were in my eyes. And that's what you see in those images. And people got it. I mean, people who read country all the time are very highly visually literate. So I got that. And we could meet on that level. They trusted me and they played with me. And if you look at many of those images in the book, you could see I often felt like people were giving me that image because they knew I'd do something good with it.
That balance between giving and taking. It's often said that pre-colonised First Peoples don't like their photographs.
It's a lot of hooey. you know,
that idea
kind
of, takes away their, that takes away their soul.
Oh, give us a break. You know, these are very sophisticated people.
So, yeah, the visual was almost like a kind of common language.
Yes,
yeah.
Absolutely. I mean, I was constantly fascinated by that ability to read landscape, to read water, to read the elements. You know, as I say, I was a learner. I was trying to learn and adapt some of these ways of knowing.
You've obviously amassed this incredible archive of photography across the decades. At what point did you realise that's what you were doing? Like, were you consciously kind of keeping and filing your images from early on? Or was there a sort of, did it take a while to realise this was all worth keeping and ordering?
How you order your archive is the essential methodology that you have to adopt to materialise what you have and to be able to access it. You know, Mick Miller rings me from the Northern Land Council. Oh, can you find that image? La, la, la. Now, I have to be able to lay my hands on that image. So I have been kind of living in an archive for as long as I've been a photographer. And one of my major concerns, and I work with archivists all the time and always wish more. I have become an archivist. I have trained people. I'm always looking for people who can work with me more, because the more order I have, the more I can create. For example, in, I think it was 1994, Michael Lee, who was working at the IATSA, said, this is about 30 years in, said, oh, do you know, how are you managing with that archive? And I sighed very long and hard and said, with great difficulty. And he said, yes, that's what I thought. He said, you need a grant. So he gave me a grant, and I got Michael Aird, who's now the head of the Queensland Museum, and he bought me Joanne Driesens, a young photographer, Murray photographer, who needed some training in printing. And she came and worked with me for 2 years, and we created a database together. Where was it? Who was it? What's the historic background? That kind of information that is key to every single event and community event I've been to. And to keep that up and keep logging it is an enormous amount of work. It's more work than I put into creating the image, actually. But it's key. And making that order out of the archive is what made doing the exhibition proof. That's what made it possible. Andrew Sayers, who was the head of the National Portrait Gallery, gorgeous guy, he came into a show I had in London. He said, I've never seen images like this before. They look so personal. There's such a clear communication. Do you think we can tell the story of the movement from the portraits? I hadn't thought of that. So he came up and portraits jumping out everywhere. So without that order, I don't have access to my own work.
And what does that archive physically look like today? Like, is it just sitting in your house? Is it in filing cabinets?
It's huge. It's all through my house. But I have what I call a digital darkroom that I'm going to show you. So there's the analog material in shelves like that, in folders, year by year by year. Then I've got the digital archive that we're just reorganising as we speak. Then in drawers, I've got field notebooks. Then I've got all this material people gave me along the way. So I live in an archive. That's where I live.
Do you have to keep building on rooms? Replaced wardrobes with compactuses?
Yeah, it's an endless struggle, but thank goodness the National Library of Australia is endlessly taking paper away from me. So I love those. They send me boxes. I fill the boxes. Of course, filling the boxes, you have to make order of it first, or else nobody wants to understand it, because everyone's nightmare is to just get a box full of stuff. So you have to create the meaning of what that work is, right, so they can decode it. And then a marvellous truck comes. It's my favourite day. And they cart out, 20, 30, 40 boxes. Bye-bye. I've got a bit of room now.
I'm interested in how the technology of photography has changed over your career. You know, you mentioned your archive contains both analogue and digital images. I mean, are you working on film anymore these days, or is it all digital? You know, how has your practice changed?
It changes all the time. MAP have asked me to do an exhibition, I think it's next year or the year after, and I am thinking of taking the visual narratives and turning them into film and letting the narratives speak to each other. So I'm constantly experimenting in new ways to rework the material.
We call this our Peak Nerd podcast, but it's usually not a technically nerdy thing. But I'm going to have to ask you, because I have a photographer son myself, and I know we will have some photography nerds listening in today. Do you remember what your first camera was?
Absolutely. It was a Pentax. Very hardy. I always choose and advise, pick a hardy, you know. For me, I'm out in the desert, I'm up in an island, you know. So I always picked very hardy cameras, and I have gone back to Leica now. For years I used an R-series Leica camera because you could drop it on the ground. It could even operate without a battery. So the stronger, the hardier, hard-working cameras, that's what I like.
And does your camera equipment form part of your archive? And do you have a museum of old cameras?
What to do with old cameras? It's a really, you know, I try and give them away, but I've got a stash of them that are, actually, I don't like sitting them, looking at them, doing nothing. You know, they should be at work.
Juno, I'm interested in the choice of the image for the cover of the book, When Justice Comes, which is your five-decade retrospective of the work. Could you tell us whether or why this image is representative of your 50-year output? Perhaps you could describe that image for us, tell us something about how it came to be.
Yeah, Claire, it goes back to that beach camp I was talking about. And as I was sitting there, I saw this family, a family related to me, just sitting there. And the way their bodies were at one with the land that they sat in and looking out so patiently, patiently waiting. That image is about family, it's about connection to country, and it's about endurance and patience. And to me, the whole movement, despite all the noise and all that and the action, it's about a people's determination to have justice and waiting for it and waiting for the next thing to act on, the next imperative. Those human qualities of patience, endurance, and determination, I think, are at the heart of it, and they're in that image, I hope.
They are, but I'm interested in the fact that they have their backs to us. It's sort of, in a sense, the opposite of portrait. We're not looking into their faces. We're not looking into their eyes. Was there some sort of symbolic feeling about that too?
I learned that from Lisette Medel, who was Diane Arbus's teacher as well. Mm. And she had a profound impact on me. Arbus also said, if I had not photographed this, people would never be able to see it. And I took that very much to heart. But Lisette's thing about photographing from the back, when they knew I was there, I'd been walking up and down the beach with the camera every day. And, you know, they were just sitting there watching and waiting, and I was sitting behind them. And it seemed to form to me such a beautiful composition in a story about a movement that involves a whole people. I didn't want to privilege anybody in particular, to say they're emblematic of the movement. So the anonymity of looking at a family from the back, I thought, was really subtle and went with the ethics I was trying to apply in that instance.
You're in your 80s now, but you're showing no signs of slowing down. What work or creative projects or travel are you excited about right now?
In about 3 weeks, I go to Europe, have book events in London and Paris, and I'm going to my favourite photography festival in all the world, Arles, which has a magnificent, huge exhibition by both Indigenous and non-Indigenous photographers there, and they have a book fair. So I'm going to be manning a stall at the book fair with not only my book, but Michael Aird's Kiara Press, and, you know, they've never really seen much of imagery from Australia before, so it's hugely challenging and it's a difficult place to get to, and to get books there, my God, it's really difficult. But it's going to be a blast, I promise you.
And Juno, almost 60 years after you had that first trip out to Central Australia, you're still tripping off into the desert. I follow you on Instagram, and you've recently had a trip out there. Just looks like you and a swag and the stars and your camera. And can you tell us about that experience, and I suppose maybe chart the growth or the journey that you've been on between that young woman who set off camera in hand, and the woman who goes there now. Do you experience it in the same way?
It's really interesting that, because I was the photographer for Central Land Council for the handback. So we go 1970, then 85, then 2000. You know, I've been going back and back. And I went to a meeting because what that project I'm working on with Diana James is we're doing a book for the Anangu to celebrate the 40th anniversary of Uluru Handback, which was such a monumental event. We're creating this book. And there was an old fellow, and he came out and he remembered me from those earlier times. He said, "God's been good to you." So moving, huh?
Yeah. Juno, we have to move towards the end of the interview, but I couldn't let you go without asking, and I hope this is not rude in any kind of way, but what happens to the archive next? I mean, you're still accumulating it. You're still a working photographer, as you've suggested. The organisation has been intrinsic to it. It's a working archive, and it's one that is used by communities. It's one that is already very much tapped into by researchers and by First Nations people themselves. What are your intentions for it?
Well, I have a huge responsibility, I feel, towards it. I'm making partnerships with the major institutions in this country so that it will be held safe at the point when I can no longer access it, somewhere on the horizon. It will go to these institutions who will take care of it, who will make access to it under some guidelines and negotiations. That's my intention, to pass it on in its entirety, such as the National Library, such as the National Museum, you know, a series of these institutions who I feel sure respect it, will look after it, and will give people access to it.
And it certainly should form part of the National Historical Collection, but there are, I guess, access issues for First Nations people whose photographs are in there. Have you also donated parts of the archive back to places like the Mulka Project in Yitikala, where they have been actively bringing back photographs?
I was one of the first contributors to the Mulka Project. I went back there in 2013 with Marcia Langton, and I took on a stick all the images I had of Galroy over the years, of Wanjak, of Bundark, of all my relationships, and we gave it to...
Joseph Brady?
No, you know, nothing as sensible as that. We gave it to Galroy. And I have no idea what's happened with it. I have asked, but I haven't got any sound reply. And the other thing is that I've made it a practice of returning, like the Uluru handbag prints are in the Culture Centre at Uluru. You've probably seen them. They've been there for 15 years. Many bodies of work have gone back to community like that. And whenever anybody's made requests, you know, I love to see it go back into community and in a safe place. So next time I go, I don't see the dog biting the prints in the dirt because it's fallen off the fridge.
So it's a form of archival repatriation,
yes,
in a way. Juno, I'm going to ask you the question we ask all of our guests here in Archive Fever. Do you have a dirty little archive secret you'd like to share with us?
This is the one that occurred to me when I was trying to think of this, is nobody knows how much documentation I've got. You know, actual texts written by Aboriginal people, notes, all this stuff. And there was one instance when we were invited to the first National Documentary Film Festival in Adelaide. And so Jerry Bostock got hold of a van. We went over there. I thought we were going to see lots of film, show film. No. We were having meetings every day. I became the secretary because somebody had to write down what was being said at the meeting. And what it was about was to call on ABC and SBS to create Indigenous broadcasting units. That foundation document, which is handwritten by me as a stenographer for Lester and Jerry and the gang, is in my archive and nobody knows about it.
Oh my goodness. I can only imagine the depths of there, and someday a curator from one of those national cultural institutions is going to lose their mind when they actually get their hands on your archive.
I'm afraid that's all we have time for today, but thank you so much for joining us, Juno, and sharing your long career and the riches that you've uncovered.
Thank you so much. I've really enjoyed it.
To learn more about Juno's work, you can go to her website, junojeems.com, or follow her on Facebook or Instagram at junojeems_photo_. Her book, Until Justice Comes, is published by Upswell, and you can find it at your local favourite independent bookstore.
You can follow Claire on Instagram at Claire Wright Historian.
And you can follow Eve on Instagram at Eve_Rees.
Don't forget, you can catch up on seasons 1-6 of the podcast via the website archivefeverpod.com. You can also listen and subscribe on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you choose to listen. And if you enjoy the podcast, please leave us a rating or review.
So until our next therapeutic session, I'm Claire Wright.
And I'm Eve Rees.
And you've been listening to Archive Fever, a La Trobe University podcast produced by Matt Smith on unceded Wurundjeri land.
Our theme music is by Poddington Bear, and you can hear more at soundofpicture.com.
Coming up on the next episode.
I felt like I want to change, I want to decolonize this place, and then I started seeing the terminology be adopted and I guess sanitized, and then people were just using it for everything. Like they were just saying like, oh, let's, you know, decolonize tennis or, you know, things of that nature. We're using decolonization as a sort of metaphor, but it's not actually shifting the end goal, I guess, of land back, or even to a certain extent, like disrupting, I guess, power imbalances.